Hi, this is Damien Qualter from Property Investment Academy, and today on the call I've got Matthew Moody. Hi Matthew, are you there?
Hi Damien, yes I am. How are you?
Great, yeah, I'm fine, thank you. On this, the sun's shining today, so it's making life a lot more bearable.
Fantastic.
Hi, Matthew, would you just give me a brief, or our listeners a brief description of, you know, what you're about, how you got started in property, and really what your specialist field is, and what sort of properties you own?
Yeah, sure. My main background, spent about 15 years in the corporate environment, working in a variety of large companies, international companies, and very much focused on pricing and inventory and managing yield. And as time went on, I progressed up the ranks and got more senior in the positions that I was on. I just kind of got to the stage where I was putting in a lot of time and effort, making some significant money for the company I was working for, but not really getting rewarded for it. So I started looking around for what alternative income streams there were that I could focus on for myself, for my own, obviously, personal benefit, that would help me ultimately be able to provide for myself in the long term.
Right.
And property was one that kind of leapt out at me. And like a lot of other investors, I happened upon a book written by Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad Poor Dad, back in 2003. Yeah, fantastic book. And, you know, a lot of the things he was talking about in there, businesses, property, and, you know, how to really move from being that employee to owning a business, really resonated with me. So probably back in 2004, I did quite a bit of research into the property market, looked at where the yields were, and one of the things that was kind of stood out to me at that time is that certainly where I was based in Northamptonshire, the yields are not particularly great for single let properties. On average, you know, you may be looking at 5 to 6% if you're lucky, 7%, you know, if you're really doing very well. But what I quickly realised was if I was going to be serious about making some good, decent cash flow in the property game, I needed to look at a property investment class that would allow me to be able to, at some point, move away from the job that I was doing and become full-time in property. And basically what it came down to was when I'd done my research, the property asset class that came out to me was houses of multiple occupation, or HMOs as they're often called.
Yep.
Or house shares, or multi-lets, a lot of variety of different names. And in 2004, I basically got started with HMOs and bought my first one in 2004, and quickly progressed until about a year later I was able to leave work, focus completely on building the portfolio up, until it got to a stage where I own, you know, I think it's about three and a half to four million, depending on what valuation you want to take at this particular point in time, of HMOs in four counties that are local to me: Northamptonshire, Cambridgeshire, Derbyshire, and I own some in Yorkshire as well. And things kind of started moving on from there, to be honest. But my focus all the way along has been on where can I generate very good, decent cash flow on an ongoing basis. And for me, HMOs was the one thing that did it every month, you know, no matter what else was happening with the outside market, interest rates, etc. Consistent cash flow every month.
Excellent. So would you mind just defining what I think people have got an idea what a HMO is, but what is the sort of proper definition of a HMO?
Right, yes, well, the official definition of a HMO is where there are two or more people sharing in a house.
Yeah.
So you could have an instance where an investor's got a two-bed flat and they may be renting it out to two people, and technically in the eyes of the law, they would class that as a HMO. But where it kind of gets a little bit vague is HMOs that are licensed and HMOs that aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when people think of HMOs, they generally think of student let.
Yes.
They perhaps think of the more downmarket HMOs where you've got maybe local housing authority tenants. And they tend to think of bigger houses. But from the point of view of, you know, what the law defines as a HMO, it's basically where there's two or more sharing. I mean, obviously, when we get a bit further into it, we'll probably talk about licensing, etc. But
sure,
for the purposes of what is a HMO, it's basically two or more people sharing in a property.
Who is it? Not a related households.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So, okay, that gives us, as I say, we'll probably come into greater detail of licensing a bit later on in the call. So, in terms of a shared house, that's the same thing as a HMO is, in terms of the law, is it?
Well, within the definition of HMO, there's actually about 9 different definitions, which is where it gets a little bit tricky, but the main one which most property investors are going to be interested in is either the traditional HMO, which is the kind of bedsit approach, where you've got rooms in a property that generally tenants will live in their room. They might have a little cooker or maybe a microwave so they can, you know, make some food, etc. And they'll probably share a bathroom. That's the traditional HMO that most people have that perception in their mind. And then the other type of HMO, which is becoming more and more popular nowadays, is a shared house. And a shared house is where the tenants are physically sharing communal facilities, such as the living room, obviously the kitchen as well, bathrooms, and other amenities such as outside space.
Right.
We'll talk a little bit more about it when we get into licensing, but the two definitions do allow you to have the law looks at them in very different ways, and what we're finding at the moment is a lot of councils are very much working with landlords to try and move out of this kind of bedsit almost mentality towards a shared house approach, because it generally brings a better class of tenant and less social problems.
Right. The other thing which I've heard, whether this is right or wrong, is it that different authorities have slightly different ways of how they define a HMO in terms of from a licensing perspective?
Yes.
Yes. All right, good.
Yes. Obviously, there are national guidelines in place, and they are very much driven from the fire safety point of view, and they don't really differ that much, to be honest. But what does differ is the local environmental officer's interpretation of the Act and what is and isn't required. I mean, one of the ones that generally gets kicked out is washhand basins in rooms. There was an amendment made about 18 months ago in the Act so that wasn't actually required anymore, but there are still some councils that are insisting upon it, and if they're not making you do it right here and now, they are saying, well, it needs to be done within a 3 or 5 year term. So, yeah, there is a little bit of grey. I'd say it's becoming a lot more standardised than when the Housing Act was introduced back in 2006, but it still does vary from county to county, and even within a county, council to council.
Well, we're politics, eh?
Well, it's not necessarily even politics, I think, Damien. It's more just that, you know, you've got, just here in Northamptonshire, I've got one council that's got 3 HMOs. I've got another council that I work with that's got over 800.
Well,
the type of approach they're going to take is always going to be very different.
Yeah.
And for good and for better.
Yeah. You'd hope so. In terms of I think most people know the answer to this, but in terms of, could you give us a real life example of the attraction of a HMO in terms of what potentially you could use an example of a property you own, say, in terms of what would you get if you let your property out as a, say, to a family, or, you know, letting it as a HMO, what's the difference in returns you could expect?
Okay.
Doing the two routes.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, I'll give you an example of a property I own in Northampton.
Yeah.
Bought it a couple of years ago. The value of it is around about £280,000.
Right.
It's a 6-bed property.
Yeah.
4 stories, so it is subject to licensing. But we'll come on to that later and tell you what that means. Now, if I was to rent that as an individual unit, the rent, I'm going to have to take a guess here because I'm not quite sure, because I don't really go down this route, but I wouldn't have thought you'd be getting more than £1,000 a month for it. Because of the area in which it's in, it's very close to the town centre, but it's not the most affluent part of town. So you know, as highly desirable as other areas. So say £1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mortgage when I initially took that out was £1,259 a month.
What? Yep.
Thankfully, due to tracker rates and stuff like, it's now about £350. But anyway, I'll give you an example of what it was like pre the base rates going down and what it is now.
Yeah.
Gross rental that we're getting on that particular unit is £2,535 a month,
wow,
which is from six rooms. The mortgage, when we initially took it over, was £1,259, and at the time, the bills were about £813. So the bills were quite high, but that's because of the size of the house and a couple of other things that just, you know, basically, you know, pushed that up a little bit.
Yeah.
So the cash flow we were generating for that particular property was £462.79.
Mm-hmm.
With the mortgage obviously now being around £350 a month, the cash flow on that is about £1,370 a month.
Beats working, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's, this is why we were attracted to HMOs in the first place, and even back in the days when interest rates were a lot higher, and, you know, there will be a time when they will come back to where they were,
mm-hmm,
you're still able to generate, you know, very good, very realistic amounts of cash every month. I mean, another example, I've got another property in Cambridgeshire. It's worth about £341,000. The rents on that for a single let, I know, are about £1,400 a month.
Yes.
So pretty good, but not really covering the mortgage, which at the time was £1,415 a month. Again, similar rent, £2,650, bills on that about £637, the mortgage was £1,415, and we were making cash flow of about £600 a month on that. That mortgage has dropped to about £700 now, so
mm-hmm,
again, you know, cash flow from that point of view has jumped up.
What one thing I've picked up from what you've mentioned, and is in terms of you're saying that there's, I guess it's you're paying the bills for things like ongoing costs. Is that correct in terms of HMOs?
Yeah, I mean,
it's not like a traditional let where, you know, the tenants have got to pay their own bills. Is that what I'm picking up on?
Yes, I mean, there are, you know, if you look at bedsits versus shared houses,
mm-hmm,
on a shared house approach, you're generally always going to be covering the bills.
Yeah.
On a bedsit, what's going to more than likely be happening is, because of the fact that it is a bedsit and you're probably inheriting that building, it's going to already have perhaps electric or gas meters in, so the tenants,
yes,
are going to be paying as they go. The landlord may only be responsible for things like the water and council tax.
Mm-hmm.
On a shared house basis, certainly the market that we're in is mainly the professional market, and
mm-hmm,
we essentially offer an all-inclusive rent to them. So we're talking about including all of the utilities, talking about including the council tax. We also include things such as broadband, Sky TV. We have a weekly maid service that basically cleans the properties, not just from the point of view of it keeps the properties clean, but also just to keep on top of things and make sure that, you know, we're looking after that asset.
Yes.
So bills can become quite high, and we as a business have taken, you know, certain decisions to do things in a certain way that make our bills slightly higher. I mean, one thing that any person looking to get into HMO should be aware of is you obviously need to furnish them. And
yeah,
furnishing can cost anything from £6,000 to £12,000, depending on how big the house is and what furnishings you're putting in.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider that maybe £2,000 of that is going to be white goods, such as fridges, freezers, tumble dryers, TVs, etc., you know, it all adds up.
Definitely.
As a business, we've taken the decision to basically rent all of that equipment, which does boost our monthly bills higher, but it means that we don't have that initial outlay.
The initial cash flow out, yeah. No, that sounds something I've learned in terms of how HMOs work. So you're going for a specific market, which is professional. You know, it sounds pretty nice, especially maid service. It sounds like staying at the Hilton.
Yeah, no, I mean, we basically aim for a kind of 4-star quality hotel experience. So,
yep,
you know, leather sofas, flat screen TVs, you know, nice furniture, so, you know, wooden furniture, none of this chipboard malarkey. and try and provide something that the tenants are going to respect, but also is going to last a good amount of time. I mean, when you look at the HMO market, to my mind, there are four distinct classes. You've got the student market, you've got what I call the migrant worker market,
mm-hmm.
you've got the key worker market, which also can encompass local housing authority tenants, and then you've got the professional market. Depending on which one of those you want to be in will really dictate your cash flow. And you can make good cash flow on any of them, but obviously the higher levels of cash flow are going to be seen in the professional market, but that is at the expense of slightly higher bills.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of looking at it from an investment point of view, in terms of choosing a property for a HMO, what would be your criteria, you know, if you were looking for a property to tick all the boxes in terms of having potential for a HMO?
Okay. Good question. But, I mean, any property could become a HMO.
Mm-hmm.
I think the main thing that people need to be looking at is the room sizes, particularly on the bedrooms. I mean, the general criteria that I normally aim for is a room has to be at least 8 meters squared, and this is because of planning restrictions and amenity space guidelines. So 8 meters squared really for a bedroom is really the minimum you should go down to. You can go a little bit smaller in certain local authorities, but you would need to speak to the housing officers to find out what that is. I generally, my kind of criteria is, when I'm looking at a property, I want to be paying no more than about £50,000 gross per room. So if, for instance, I'm looking at, I don't know, say it's a four-bed property,
mm-hmm.
Then if it's more than £200,000, it won't work, it won't stack up for me.
Yes.
Because you're just paying slightly too much for the building.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be looking for at least one bathroom for four people, and you need a kitchen that's big enough for everybody to cook food in and store food in. And ideally, if you want to go down the more professional route, you need a separate living room.
Yes.
So you can have any type of property. I mean, you could buy a three-bed terrace, you know, you could buy one of those for maybe $100,000. If you've got two reception rooms in it, which you may be lucky enough to get, you may be able to convert one of those into a bedroom,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have quite a nice little cash machine there.
Definitely, no. It sounds very, very intriguing. I say I'm learning as I go along this. I didn't really know much about HMOs, but it's certainly making my ears prick up a little bit. And I think. So in terms of lending on HMOs,
right.
Are there any restrictions in terms of lenders who will, give you a mortgage against HMO properties?
Yes, I mean, that's kind of the catch at the moment, I have to
mm-hmm.
say. I mean, because of the liquidity issue that we've seen in the financial markets, HMOs were one of the investment classes that were kind of hit first.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, a lot of it is because the underwriters don't understand, you know, the different classes of HMOs. They just see a HMO as kind of a bedsit.
Yes.
You know, it's fine, and it's something that we need to work with them on to try and educate them. But at the moment, I'd say realistically, you're looking at 70% LTV from commercial lenders for
mm-hmm.
HMOs. It's very difficult to get more than that. There are a couple of lenders that may be coming back into the market that would go to 75%, but until they've actually confirmed that, you know, I wouldn't like to say who they are. But
yes.
Right now, it's commercial lending up to 70%, and on those kind of lenders, you're looking at base plus 2.25 to 2.75 above base.
Right.
So it's not too bad.
No, that's actually not bad at all. It's, you know, considering probably what the normal buy-to-let criteria is, it seems pretty much in line with it, probably a slightly lower LTV. But in terms of, I suppose, what you could do with this, if you were in a position to buy property where you've negotiated a substantial discount off it,
yeah.
Then it could really sort of stack up in terms of numbers. If you're getting a 25 to 30% discount and then converting it to a HMO sort of occupancy, you know, you could be really sort of making some attractive numbers on it.
Sure, yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, when you look at the demand for HMOs at the moment, what we're certainly finding is more and more people are looking to save money at the moment, you know, for a variety of reasons. And at the moment, we're getting a lot of people who are looking to basically downgrade from having their own flat to living in a professional house share.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, you know, demand's pretty good at the moment. And, you know, if you're living in a city that's got more than about 50,000 population, generally speaking, there should be some demand for HMOs in your area. And what I'd encourage your listeners to do is go to a website called spareroom.com. So that's just spareroom.com.
Yeah.
And basically on there, it's a free-to-use website. You have to register to get some of the advanced functions, but you can basically look at who's looking for a room and how many rooms are out there in your local area. You can do it by postcode or city, and it's a really good indication just to understand what the demand looks like for a particular area. And, you know, once you've found that there is demand, which, as I say, if you're in a good-sized city, there pretty much is always demand, then it's just a case of finding the right property. And when I first got started, I was buying some of the real big properties, so, you know, £350,000, you know, pound properties, which are good in terms of a lot of my first properties were new builds, so the maintenance issues on them are practically non-existent. But in terms of adding value, very difficult to do. So what I've been doing in the last 18 months or so is buying resale units, older properties, refurbing them completely, adding value through that way, and then obviously, you know, trying to extract a little bit of cash to pay for the conversion. So, you know, if I was starting today in this market, I'd probably look at both, to be honest. Obviously, developers get some great discounts at the moment from there. So if you can get in a nice townhouse-type property with rooms that are big enough, then that could be a great buy. And similarly, if you can get a resale unit with a good enough discount on that, that could be the way for you as well.
So the sort of both routes you can go, the older type properties or new build. In terms of what sort of work would you have to do to a property then? Is this coming into the licensing aspect to conform to the legal responsibilities of a landlord? You know, what sort of works need to be done in the property to make it to conform, I suppose, to each council's legal requirements?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I say, I mean, it does differ slightly, but and there's guidelines coming out all of the time that where they're adjusting things, but I think the main thing to bear in mind is that all of the licensing requirements are basically around the 2004 Housing Act and then the HHSRS system, which I know is a bit of a mouthful, but if you listeners aren't aware of that, that's the Housing Health and Safety Rating System. So everything that the councils are looking for is basically to protect tenants.
Yeah.
And I guess where this then becomes a little bit vague in terms of what you actually need to put into a property is where the licensing comes in. Regulations basically stipulate that if a HMO is three or more stories high and has five or more people in more than one household and they share amenities such as bathrooms, toilets and cooking facilities, then it's classed as a mandatory HMO. So for instance, if say we had a three-story property and we had four people in, then that would be a HMO, but it wouldn't be classed as a mandatory license HMO.
Right.
Similarly, if we had a two-story property with six people in, it is a HMO, but it's not. It doesn't necessarily need to be licensed. Now, all licensing means, in effect, is that the council is basically licensing your property as being suitable to being run as a HMO according to the guidelines that they see fit to, you know, to obviously implement. So that these will be things such as generally fire doors on all of the hot areas. This is something they're very keen on. So this is bedrooms and kitchens. They're generally looking for mains interlinked fire detection system. Depending on what type of HMO it is it a three-story? If it's a three-story, it'll generally be a fire panel, zoned alarms. There'll be the push buttons that you have on each landing, so you can set the alarm off. If it's a two-storey property, it's generally more often just going to be an interlink system, so if one goes off, they all go off.
Yeah.
But again, it does differ, and this is something that can be negotiated with the fire officers, depending on what your management capabilities are like. They generally always want heat detectors in the kitchen. They generally always want cookers for every four people.
So what sort of costs would be involved in sort of putting all this technology in place, say, in a, you know, a, I don't know, a four-bedroom property? You know, just a rough idea.
Yeah, well, it's not as bad as you think, really. I mean, fire doors, we generally put in the cost of £200 a door, mm-hmm. which is for the door, the furniture, the overhead closers, and fitting.
Yeah.
So however many doors you've got, times 200, that's going to give you a pretty good figure. For the fire detection system, up until 18 months ago, we were paying about £3,000 to £3,500 per fire detection system that we put in. We've now found a very good firm based in Leicester that can do it for about £1,500 to £2,000. So
yeah.
It's quite a big saving, and that is with a fire panel, full certificates, you know, everything included. So. Yeah, I'd say if you're allowed £2,000 for a fire detection system in anything up to a six-bedroom property, you'd pretty much be covered.
And in terms of the doors, is that every door in the property, or is it just the doors to the actual rooms? Or
it's basically anything that they classify as a hot area. So this is anything where somebody could set something alight. So the only areas you wouldn't need a door on are the bathrooms.
Right.
Because obviously there's running water in there at all times. And
yes. Most doors would be classed as a,
yeah.
You'd need to put a fire door on.
I mean, the main thing I'd say is, you know, if your listeners are interested in going into HMOs, then the first thing to do is ring up your local council.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be honest, they're the best people to speak to. Most of them are quite friendly and will actually help you out. You know, we've worked with councils, you know, across the UK, and some of the guys, you know, we'll get them to come and look at a property before we even buy it. So, you know, what do you think? Is it going to work? Blah, blah, blah. And they'll give us their opinion. But obviously, you know, you need to build on that relationship. You can't just ring them up and just say, I've got this property, can you come over? It does take a bit of time. But if you go and speak to them, you know, go and meet them if you want. That's always good. Put a face to the name. Tell them what you're trying to do. Tell them the types of HMOs that you're looking to do. And they'll generally give you all the help that you need.
Right, so it's they're a really good free resource, really.
It
which,
is. Definitely.
I suppose, you know, at the end of the day, they're the ones who are you know, making the decisions whether what you need to do to comply and everything.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's go into a little bit about licensing now. Could you explain that, you know, in layman's terms, so we can understand in terms of what needs to be done and
yeah.
What you need to do in terms of be on the right side of the law?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I said earlier, if your property does need to be licensed as a HMO, I mean, one of the things that people often get caught up on is, when is a HMO a HMO? And as we said right at the beginning of the call, when there's two or more people sharing a property, it's a HMO. Where the licensing comes in is really... Mandatory licensing is for a property that's three or more stories high with five or more people in the property sharing amenities. And
yeah.
All that means is you need to apply to the council for a licence. And what's the licence for? The licence basically saying that they're happy that it's suitable for occupation by the number of people that you've applied for under the licence. It's saying that you're a fit and proper person to manage that property. It's saying that the management arrangements in place are satisfactory. And it's really, essentially, it's a rubber stamp. It's saying, yeah, this property's fine to operate as a HMO. And the licence, generally, the application form is anything from 20 to 40 pages.
Wow.
Just depends on the council. But at the moment, I'm seeing them about 30 pages long. A lot of it is repeated, but you know that's just unfortunately bureaucratic. You know, bureaucrats for you.
Yeah.
So you fill all that in, you send a lot of supporting evidence to them, such as gas safety certificates, electrical appliance testing, smoke alarm certificates, ASTs, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you generally send them a fee at that stage, and you know, the fee is one thing that, you know, does sometimes annoy me, in that the fee can be anything from £300 to £1,200, depending on where you are in the country.
So it's different across the UK, really?
Completely different. And it's not even necessarily driven by additional work that the council do, because they all seem to do the same things. It's just the fee does seem to differ widely, and not quite understand why that is. And I know the NLA are trying to look into it as well, but it's just something that, unfortunately, it does differ quite a bit. So you send your fee off, and then what will generally happen is they'll be in contact. They'll come round to view the property with generally a fire officer. They'll make any recommendations that need to be done, such as, you know, you need to put the fire door in here, or if your fire alarm's not satisfactory, they say, well, you need to do this, this and this. They'll generally give you 3 to 6 months to do that, and then they'll come back and inspect that you've done the work. You know, there is obviously some element of negotiation here in terms of what they're asking for. You know, if they've come in and said they want sprinkler systems, you know, that's a bit over the top. But, you know, as long as you work with them, tell them where you are, tell them what you're doing, tell them how the work's progressing, you know, they're generally fine to work with. Once that work's been done, then at some point they will issue a licence, which will generally last for 5 years. Now, in terms of how quickly that process happens, the quickest we've had it happen is 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The longest we've had it happen is 2 years on, we're still waiting for one to be issued.
So what would you do with the property in the meantime before you're actually granted a licence?
Well, again, it's not exactly black and white, but what the housing officers will always tell you is, providing you've applied for a licence, providing that you're doing all of the work, then, you know, you're basically covered in so much as they're not going to take you to court for not having a licence, because it's on their onus to issue the licence now you've done the work.
Sure.
So, you know, as long as you're in communication with them, you're very open with what you're doing, you've told them what's happening, then generally they're fine, because the council are the only people that are going to take you to court for not having a licence. And, you know, the maximum fine that they can fine you is £20,000. Well, they're not going to do that if you've put in your application, you've put in the various amenities that they've asked for, but they've not issued a licence yet. That's really just more of a processing issue at their end.
So the process is, you know, you fill in your application, they come out, hopefully, you know, most of the stuff will be correct. There might be one or two things which they might want you to rejig around slightly, and then it's just the case then that the application and license is rubber stamped, and you would actually receive the license off the authority.
Yeah.
In the fullness of time.
Yeah, that's right.
In terms of, obviously, there seems to be a lot of advantages of HMOs. What are the drawbacks?
What are the drawbacks?
If there are any.
Yeah. No, there are always a few. I mean, generally speaking, I guess one of the things that many people say is that HMOs are a lot of hassle and take a lot of work. And generally, most people that say that have never managed a HMO in their life, nor set foot in one.
Yeah.
But I do tend to agree with them in terms of it is more hassle and more work than managing a single let. On average, when you've got a HMO set up and you've got tenants actually in the property, you can generally manage a HMO, you know, within less than 2 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, however many HMOs you've got, it's not going to take you more than 2 hours per week to manage that one property. Where you tend to spend a lot of time and energy is getting tenants through, showing tenants around, and managing that whole process of taking a tenant from being a potential tenant to converting them to actually handing out the deposit, moving into your property, etc.
This is probably the next question I was going to ask you, in terms of how would you market for potential tenants for your properties?
The marketing side, 90% of what we do is online.
Mm-hmm.
We generally advertise on about 15 to 20 sites online.
Mm-hmm.
And the main ones being Spare Room and Easy Roommate, about there where most of the people looking for rooms will look. And essentially, I mean, we've been doing it for some time now, so we've got a pretty good marketing system in place where leads come in, they're contacted, they're entered into an autoresponder database, they're followed up by text and email, and, you know, we generally get viewings from those.
Right, so you've got the system which sort of follows the thing through, and
yeah.
I suppose you've got a potential list of future people as well if you know, they're not ready at that market just at the time,
yeah.
time being when you've got something vacant.
That's right.
Yeah, sounds good.
Come back as well on you saying what are the kind of hassles or issues around HMOs. I think the main one that I'd say is bills are a constant source of concern, I guess, in terms of specifically utility bills, gas and electric, keeping on top of those. Tenants, when it is an all-inclusive rent, they do tend to be a little more, shall we say, laissez-faire about heating and
yeah.
running water and tumble dryers and that type of thing. So, you know, we're kind of very proactive with that in terms of having things on time, having thermostats set at certain levels, telling everybody that comes through the door, these are the kind of energy rules, these are what you need to know about, but you are still going to get energy bills that do fluctuate. So, I mean, that is one of the problems. I think the other issue, I guess, can be when you've got a house that take it upon themselves to offload all their problems onto you with other tenants, and that's generally because of a lack of immaturity on their part. It doesn't happen very often, but, you know, when it does happen, it can become a little bit of a hassle, so you've almost got to go around there and, you know, act as a father or mother figure and try and sort them out.
Yeah, so it does happen with traditional buy-to-lets as well in terms of, you know, I think occasionally, you know, with anything you do, in any sort of business venture, you're always going to have some sort of problem and, you know, I don't think it'd be any worse apart from that they're all living under one household, and I suppose it's like having a family of children, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
To lick into shape.
Definitely.
What would you say... five top tips for potential HMO landlords in terms of buying property. You know, what would you give as some advice to someone considering a HMO,
yeah,
where to get started?
Well, basically, we use an 8-step system, which is around the acronym property, and this is basically how we buy property. So, the P stands for preparation.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely important to A, know where you're going, and B, have the right goals set in place in terms of what you're actually going to do once you've got the properties, and have a business plan or goals or cash flow set aside. Because I think a lot of people don't approach it from that angle, and that's one of the failings. The second one is R, which is the right property and the right demand. There's no point buying property in the wrong area, which there is no demand for. For instance, a lot of new developments, although they've got some fantastic houses in them, are just not in the right part of town. They're either too far out of town, or they're in an area which is very much geared towards families and not necessarily young professionals. Young professionals generally want to be somewhere close to shops, entertainment, bus routes, etc.
Sure.
So that's really important. The next one is O, for organising finances. It's really important, especially in today's market with HMOs, to make sure that you are speaking to people before you're going out there looking for HMOs, because you may end up finding a fantastic deal but not having a lender that will be willing to lend on it.
Are you, in terms of funding, are you going to a specialist HMO funder, or are you speaking to your banks, or a mix of both?
We basically, as I mentioned, we use a variety of commercial lenders, which when we get on to talking about some of the resource at the end, I'll just tell people when and get hold of some of that information. But
yeah,
it's mainly commercial lending. So finance is really important. The next one is P, which is property makeover. And this is all about ensuring that once you've got that property, you've got the finances on board, then you need to be thinking about how you're going to set it up correctly so that tenants will walk round, and somewhere in the house you need what we call a wow factor.
Mm-hmm.
You need tenants to walk through the door, maybe, you know, in the living room you might have like a 40-inch LCD TV, or you might have a massive mirror or whatever it is, and just go, wow, you know, it's a really nice house, blah, blah, blah. So it's really important to get the house looking in the right way.
Yeah.
The next one is E for enabling the correct business systems. Because one of the things that we found when we talk to people is a lot of investors, and I think it is changing now because a lot of the amateur investors pulled out the market, but they're not treating property as a business, and they're not putting the appropriate systems in place. And one of the things that we're quite keen on, and when we talk to people, it's really top of the agenda, is what systems have you got in place for managing the business?
Mm-hmm.
Because you need those in order to be able to monetize what's going on a daily basis, understand what's coming in, what's going out, and understand how you're getting tenants in, you know, conversion rates, all that type of thing can only happen if you have the right systems in place. And that leads on to R, which is renting the property. If you have the right systems in place, so, you know, we've invested in developing our marketing system, then that's the next critical factor, is renting that property. T is for taking massive cash flow, because as we've kind of discussed over the course of the call, it's fairly easy to make 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, even £1,000 a month cash flow. And then once you've done that, it's on to Y, which is your next property. What are you waiting for? So that's kind of what we do.
Yeah. So, well, as I say, it's been fantastic. Cool. I've learnt, I've had a very basic understanding of HMOs, but certainly what you've gone through today has covered a lot of things which I wasn't sure of, and certainly clarified a lot of things as well. You know, I've really enjoyed speaking to you on the call. Are there any resources, and if anyone wants to find out any more information about yourself, where they can go to and get some more information?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the main website I have is yourhmoexpert.com.
Yeah.
So that's yourhmoexpert.com. And on there, it's basically set up around a blogging software. So generally, every day, there's a new post on there. It's to do with HMOs and property investment. It's free advice. There's also a 10-part e-course, which it seems to be a little bit at the moment, and I'm trying to jazz it up so people can see it, but that is essentially a 10-part e-course which is based around the 8-step property system that we talked about earlier, and it goes into a lot more detail of researching your demand, you know, getting your property set up correctly, etc., etc. So people are more than welcome to go on to yourhmoexpert.com. We're doing a few videos and podcasts and things at the moment, just trying to, you know, change the site and get a little bit more interaction with listeners. So, yeah, that's the place to go to.
And in terms of, you mentioned resources for lenders and things like that. Is that on your website as well? Yeah. Everything's there.
Yeah, there's a section somewhere in there. There's a search function, so if you can't see it straight away, do a little search, and if you still can't find it, just send me an email.
Fantastic. Well, I'll say I've really enjoyed the call today.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure again to speak to someone. I do like learning, and you know, every call I make with all the experts, yeah, I certainly come out learning more. One day I'll be an expert on something. You know, it's nice to have people in their specialist fields who've sort of gone through the mill and learnt, you know, how to do processes properly. Thanks again, Matthew, and
no,
you know, for people out there, you know, go to the website and check Matthew's website out and get the e-course. Thanks again, Matthew.
All right, thanks, Damien.